Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Hey, and welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Radulski. I'm a co-host, Dr. Carl Radulski, super endocrinologist. Yeah. And we are going to be talking just about a few trials today that came out around these GLP-1 medicines. We talk about these all the time. My brother's an endocrinologist, obesity specialist. I'm a family doctor specialized into obesity and lipidology. And I made a tweet the other day.
Touch on some cardiology today. So I suppose we should have had Aunt Mary Jo on or something.
Yeah, we could have it. We could have a cardiology. We have a lot of cardiology friends. Yeah.
Perhaps the way we describe heart failure might be a little bit better for the lay people out there than a cardiologist, though, because we have to describe
it simply. Well, and this we did touch on this a few months back when another similar type of trial came out about semaglutide. Today, there's a few trials. There's one with semaglutide and heart failure. Then there's one with lixizenatide. Which is now discontinued, right? You don't prescribe that.
No, it's combined with glargine in the form of Soliqua.
But by its monotherapy,
it's never really been available in the United States.
You can't get it.
By itself, it has been in other countries. We can talk about why that's the case, but it
doesn't really matter. So that one was actually really interesting looking at Parkinson's. So we're starting to get away from just straight up cardiometabolic. We're starting to get away from cardiometabolic health and into other neurological conditions, and they're actually studying it for Alzheimer's. And I think this showcases just how these medicines, I made a tweet the other day that people seem to like. I was like, we can't just simply call these weight loss drugs. And I know people want to call them anti-obesity or weight management drugs. So I agree with that. That's fine. But these drugs do help with weight loss.
Well, let's not forget that they were originally, back when I was in med school, I think before you were even in med school or your first year, exenatide was approved for type 2 diabetes. So they have always been metabolic treatment medicines.
Yeah.
As opposed to the, you know, even though I really think the underlying root issue is obesity-ish that they're treating, but they have so many broad effects.
So I made the tweet that we got to stop thinking of these as just simply weight loss drugs and more as health-promoting medicines and therapies, because honestly, like as we saw with the SELECT trial, we talked about that in terms of reducing major adverse cardiovascular events, that it looks like it's going beyond weight loss. And one of the other drugs that we talked about in that didn't even lower people's weight that much, but in type 2 diabetes actually prevented heart attacks. So we're starting to see this. Mm-hmm. There's some other really thing. I've been interviewed by a few reporters out there talking about this new Ozempic baby boom thing that we're starting to see. And like, look, it needs to be studied, but I think there's something going on in the HPO axis, the hypothalamic pituitary ovarian axis. Something is going on that's increasing fertility in those who otherwise are not.
And the simple obvious part of that is, you know, in my world with obesity, diabetes, PCOS, and infertility, weight reduction improves those.
That's the obvious thing, but there's
the less obvious things that are even there's more
some,
interesting.
Yeah, there's something else going on. I've had patients describe them getting normalized periods without any weight reduction right when they first started. Yeah, and then
so it makes you wonder, you know, this gets a little beyond what people want to hear about, but you know, when we think about you know, some of the hypothalamic, pituitary, sex organ axis stuff, you know, it relates to the leptin hormone from the adipose tissue, right? Working up in the area of the hypothalamus. One of the hormones that all my endocrine nerd friends used to tease me that I thought was interesting was that kisspeptin, right? And that plays a role with the hypothalamic, pituitary control over
upstream from what we usually think of.
And so, you know, so when we start modulating all these things, even without a change in the adiposity, which certainly if you lose the weight, we know that that's helpful, right? But then we know that there must be other things going on. That's beyond my current understanding and probably beyond a lot of people's current understanding.
There's some things going on. So let's pull up the Parkinson's study and maybe you can talk a little bit about lixizenatide.
Yeah. I mean, so first of all, I mean, you know, and you as a more of a primary care doctor, you may have a better way to describe Parkinson's, but it's a, you know, it's a neurodegenerative disease that people may have at least heard about. And it's not uncommon, unfortunately, and it's very debilitating. And, you know, it has to do with dopamine, et cetera. And what people develop are these features like that resting tremor. Do you remember the pill rolling tremor? It's not like what I see with hyperthyroidism, where people are just having these fine tremors. If anybody's watching, I'm like shaking here. But it's like this resting, and it's not an intention tremor. That's more of a kind of a benign thing. But it's like they're pill rolling all the time, and they become very rigid and slow. But there are other, you know, complications of it, like our autonomic nervous system doesn't work well, sleep disorders, and certainly very concerning is like cognitive, like, you know, mental health decline. And the progression of the disease is just, you know, heartbreaking for the person, the family, everything like that. And, you know, there are a lot of researchers working on neuroprotective treatments that are potentially slowing or delaying this stuff. And somehow, I think in animal trials is where somehow, you know, the GLP-1 receptors, I think people found could be modulated for this. And hence, yada, 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 animal studies led to trying lixizenatide because of the neuroprotective properties in mouse models of Parkinson's. So lixizenatide is a very short-acting GLP-1 receptor agonist. It was approved in other countries for type 2 diabetes. It is not by any means one of the more potent ones.
Not much weight loss.
No, not a lot of weight reduction. It had a relatively neutral cardiovascular outcome trial itself, but we do still have it available. It's in combination with a basal, meaning your a fasting type of insulin. It's the brand name is called Soliqua. And sometimes we end up using it in people with diabetes that for a variety of reasons, we don't have to get into, but it is still available itself. But
I thought it was approved in the US as Adlixin.
It may have been, but
hey, but it was not long. And I remember getting drug reps back when I graduated from residency, and it was like they'd come in and be like, what is this? Anyway, it doesn't really matter. Anyway, you can't get it by itself.
So not the point. But what they did, basically, the bottom line is
it was a
phase 2 trial. So, you know, we can talk
by the about way, anybody Parkinson's, if you want to see an example, Michael J. Fox is the most probably famous example. He's donating a lot, and you can see how it progresses and how his movements are. It's a debilitating disease. He's doing, you know, as well as one could, but it's really sad to see. Let's see. Anyway, go over the
phase. I guess, well, this by the way, this study was funded by the French Ministry of Health and Michael J. Fox.
Oh, are you serious?
No, I'm joking. Yes. But the French Ministry of Health, it was I thought maybe it'd be cool if it was Michael J. Fox, but it's not. But maybe he, you know, who knows? Maybe he may have helped out. He does donate a lot of money to this stuff. So anyway, so it was a phase 2, you know, so not a phase 3, but it's a double blinded randomized placebo controlled trial. And they basically just compared lixizenatide to placebo. Lixizenatide is a daily subcutaneous injection. They did it for 12 months in people in whom Parkinson's disease was diagnosed less than 3 years earlier and were already receiving stable dose of their medications to treat the symptoms and did not yet have motor, meaning, you know, physical movement type complications. So they did a 2-month washout period, meaning they stopped it at the end. And what they were looking for was a change from baseline in scores of this the scale called the Movement Disorder Society Unified Parkinson's Disease Rating Scale. Part 3. And that
we're going to have to get a neurologist on our trip. We don't know what the hell we're talking about.
No, not even close.
We had to go through this. He did internal medicine. I did family medicine. We had patients like this.
We did the training, but that's, if we want more details on this, they could go through it. But the bottom line is that the score ranges from 0 to 132 with higher scores indicating greater motor disability, meaning so a high score is bad. And this was assessing patients on the medication at 12 months. They also looked at some other like mental health scores at 6, 12, 14 months. And And, you know, and they were on this stuff called levodopa, which is essentially dopamine treating the, deficiency. And so, you know, they had 156 patients, 78 to each group. And the baseline score of that score we just talked about was about 15, okay, in each group. At 12 months, the score went down. It basically did not change much in the Ligzi-Zenitide.
Right, they kind of prevented it. Progression. And how basically, long was this trial? A year?
It was a year. So the score was negative 0.04. So that doesn't sound like much, but it's essentially no change, and if anything, going in the right direction. Whereas the placebo group had a 3-point higher score, which, you know, may not sound like a lot, but you can imagine if that's additive over time. And so, you know, the bottom line, their conclusion was that in early Parkinson's disease, Ligzi-Zenitide therapy resulted in less progression of motor disability than placebo at 12 months. You know, I had some gastrointestinal side effects like these all do, but, you know, they're going to go on to phase 3 trials now.
And I think, pretty cool. You know, when you think about, like, with Parkinson's and the motor movement and potentially depression that may come along with it from the disease process, just having it, not necessarily because of it, but it might be the right drug because it doesn't cause weight loss, that much weight loss. And you don't want like massive amounts of weight loss, unless somebody, of course, if somebody has obesity, you treat the obesity, but I could see that being why they chose it. I don't know why they chose it. Does it say anything in there about the introduction
I'd
about
into the
that
details? And maybe that, hey, so if any neurologists that we're friends with are listening to this and would like to get on and give us some more insight, we'd love to have you on as a guest. You know, for some of the more sciencey details as to how that came about, the history of that. But it's interesting to learn about, and maybe some good things for the future. Something
there. And so, just for anybody listening, GLP-1, it depends on and why we're seeing different types of GLP-1s coming out. So half-life is one thing, but how they penetrate various areas of the body, including the brain, is another thing. How they hit the receptors is another thing, because if they hit the receptor in a certain way, it can have then downstream processes are different than another GLP-1 agonist that hits the receptor. It's really interesting stuff. And what we're going to see are all sorts of those types of new drugs coming out.
And kind of the lipophilic versus the hydrophilic and all that. So, you know, like, right, all those things.
Well,
sorts of little differences.
The thing that we're seeing, like, so they call them GLP-1 biased receptor. This is what, when Zepbound or tirzepatide came out, everybody's like, is it the GIP that's doing it? Well, there's some thoughts that it's the actual GLP-1 component, despite it not having as much affinity to the receptor as like, say, semaglutide. It may actually help with the sensitivity of the receptors stay out longer, all sorts of crazy stuff.
Yeah.
And with the orforglipron coming out, similar stuff that, like, we need molecular scientists on here to kind of describe it.
Well, yeah. In the past 2 minutes, we just sounded like Huberman and everyone just hung up on us. So,
well, no, maybe they're probably going to send us money. Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're going to give us money.
Sounds good.
Okay. Let's go. Okay. So, you know, the reason we're showcasing this is because it's like, look, hey, these drugs are being studied for more things. I think they're going to be studied for PCOS, fertility. I think all sorts of stuff.
All that's already happening. Absolutely. So So a big deal though in obesity, type 2 diabetes, and high cardiometabolic cardiovascular risk is heart failure, right? So heart failure, essentially the basic simple way I would describe it to a person is the heart is not receiving or pumping the blood appropriately. Okay. And you know, it's a symptoms that essentially are caused by the inability of the ventricles, the big muscles of the heart, to pump at normal pressures because
this one was preserved. This one's preserved.
This specific one, yeah. So I just think people need to know kind of the difference, what that means, right? So heart failure generally is described by people as having shortness of breath. They're feeling really fatigued. They have minimal exercise tolerance, and they often will feel like they're fluid retaining, like lower extremity swelling and all that stuff. And it's a big deal. It's associated with very high risk of dying in the relative near future, unfortunately. And we've come a long way in the past 15, 20 years, really since we've been in med school, with therapies to minimize that and elongate people's lives. Well, So the heart failure with a reduced ejection fraction, so that's the actual pumping of the blood to the body, we call that a systolic dysfunction. That's usually caused by like heart attacks, also by high blood pressure, which of course high blood pressure, the leading cause of that is obesity, you know, adiposity. Whereas obesity is very strongly associated with a lot of heart failure with what they call preserved ejection fraction. So that's the diastolic dysfunction where it's not necessarily the pumping. I guess I would kind of describe it as the receiving of it. How would you describe it to people?
They can't get enough blood into their heart because their heart's too thick to even get much blood out. But the percent that's coming out is looks about the same as a normal heart. Yeah.
Not working right.
Yeah, because you don't get enough blood in, you're not getting as much blood out either. That's my very layman's
term.
So whereas in other ejection fraction, with reduced ejection fraction, they're getting a ton of blood in and it's floppy and it can't get the blood out.
Yeah,
whatever.
That's huge.
We should get a cardiologist.
It's a big difference. Well, and it's a big difference between these two things is the way they're treated, what causes them, etc. But the heart failure with preserved ejection fraction or diastolic dysfunction has been a little bit more of a relatively recent entity that's been studied and figured out in people. And in the world of, you know, diabetes and then heart failure and kidney disease, we have those SGLT2 inhibitors like Jardiance and Farxiga, Invokana, where they trick the kidneys into peeing out sugar. And they turned out to be dramatically huge and beneficial for all of heart failure, especially the reduced ejection fraction. But this preserved ejection fraction is still been a little bit more, I think, a little bit of a mystery wrapped in a riddle for research. And so in this case,
not much there. They didn't have many therapies to do it. That's why all these new things, it's like, wow, if we can actually improve outcomes here, it's a big deal.
Heart failure is a big deal. And so, and in fact, you know, and then not only obesity, but then of course, if you have obesity with diabetes, the rate of incidence heart failure hospitalizations is actually double what it is if you don't have diabetes. So the more disease progression you have just in general, the worse it is. And certainly, you know, heart attacks, strokes, you know, ischemic heart disease plays a significant role. And just in general, for everyone, all cardiovascular risk factors need to be optimized. So we're talking about weight reduction for obesity and some of those downstream complications like hyperglycemia, blood sugars, blood pressure, lipids, certainly, you know, smoking so bad for all this stuff, the kidney disease that can come with it. And obviously, in our world, we want everyone working out, physical activity and exercise. But there are no FDA approved therapies that specifically treat all three, obesity, diabetes, and heart failure preserved ejection fraction all at the same time. And so that's kind of what they were looking at with these GLP-1s. And in this case, semaglutide, which is Ozempic or Wegovy. And it was really just based upon some noting preclinical and clinical data in obesity and diabetes. It was suspected that semaglutide, Ozempic, Wegovy would have the potential to do these, have these benefits.
Yeah. We reported on the trial that came out a few months ago that was without type 2 diabetes and heart failure. This one is with type 2 diabetes, correct?
Yeah. Yes. So just to kind of go through that a little bit, and we've talked about how one of the OGs, the liraglutide or Victoza in type 2 diabetes and essentially established atherosclerotic or like heart attack, stroke type risk, reduced the risk several years ago for those people to have more heart attacks, strokes, and death. And then the Ozempic version of semaglutide in type 2 diabetes and high cardiovascular risk overall reduced the risk of heart attack, strokes, driven by stroke reduction, by the way, and just overall cardiovascular death. And then for these heart failure studies, so they use, here we go with another score, right? But they use the Kansas City Cardiomyopathy Questionnaire Clinical Summary Score. This score ranges from 0 to 100, and higher scores, in this case, indicate fewer symptoms and physical limitations. So for example, for those with obesity but no diabetes, the one we talked about before, that score ultimately ended up being 17 points higher, so better for the semaglutide group than the 9 points higher for the placebo group. At that study that we talked about before also came with about 11% more weight reduction than the placebo group. And remember, everyone's getting nutrition and exercise guidance. Another really cool thing about this, these are not the primary endpoints, but they do the 6-minute walk time, right? So we talked about how exercise tolerance and shortness of breath and all that stuff is very limiting and disabling for people. They were able to get almost 22 meters more in 6 minutes compared to just 1.2 meters more for the placebo group.
And I believe this is similar to the study that came out a few months ago. It's very similar.
You want to know why it was similar? Because I was just reviewing that study. That was that study.
Okay. That was that study.
I was just reviewing that. Yes.
Oh,
that
okay.
Why that's very
so the new. However, so the newer. So yes, then what's so the new one?
In heart failure with preserved ejection fraction.
With type 2 diabetes.
And type 2 diabetes. And remember, less weight reduction with all these medications if you have type 2 diabetes.
It was like 6% or something. It was not much.
But it was 6.5 points more than, or it was 14 points with higher with the treatment group, 6 points with the placebo group. So an overall 8 points more than that. And again, that's clinically statistically significant. And there was a 10% weight reduction versus 3.4%. So like, I think that's what you're saying, about 6% more than placebo. So first of all, 3.5% weight reduction in people with type 2 diabetes and heart failure, I actually think that's really darn good.
For a placebo.
Yeah, it is.
That's not bad.
To get 10% is potentially game changing. And here's the 6-minute walk difference. Those people were able to achieve 14 more meters in the 6-minute walk advancement than those on placebo. Just so think about the vicious cycle of that, how they are improving how they feel, probably reducing the risk of death, and they're able to do more exercise, which is going to help everything. I mean, that's remarkable.
That's a big deal. Ideally, we'd prevent all this stuff from happening in the first place, but it's good to have treatments to actually treat it, because it's pretty bad when you get this type of thing and very debilitating, and just like in Parkinson's. So it's good that we have these. What else do we need to talk? I mean, I think this is just kind of, we're trying to get the gist out there that these things are helping more. I mean, clearly there's weight loss, not with alixazanetide and the Parkinson's, but like with this, there's some weight loss involved and maybe that's part of it, but I don't think so. I think there's something else. There's GLP-1 receptors on the myocytes,
in the heart.
There's things going on that, like, I don't know. And you can just imagine newer therapies that they're going to start studying that might penetrate and hit the receptors differently. I don't know.
Yeah.
I think
the bottom line for people to understand is not to think of these as weight loss. You know, we go over and over again, this is not a cosmetic disease. This is a real disease process. Obesity drives the risk of diabetes, heart failure, all these things. Yes, we want to prevent it. We don't always need these medications to treat, you know, relatively benign, low risk obesity at first. But when they start having these problems, it's literally what's on the inside that counts. These are treating real debilitating disease processes and preventing worsening complications, reducing risk of death. Really good stuff for people, as opposed to the naysayers out there like Mark Hyman, who thinks, I don't know why he's so anti. I guess because it reduced. I don't know why. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah, he stops making money. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. Anyways.
All right. Well, thanks for listening. You know, if you have anybody you want to share this with that has heart failure, it might be something interesting to talk about. Preserved ejection fraction, of course, mind you, but lots of it. So share this with a friend. Thanks.
Godspeed.
And here's our outro.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities. We'll be right back.